Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. The first segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Nadine Hill, director of the National Niemann-Pick Disease Foundation. So tell me a little bit about the Disease Foundation.
Okay, the National Niemann-Pick Disease Foundation was founded in 1992. We are a patient-run, nonprofit organization that assists families who have a child diagnosed with the fatal disease, which is very rare, and it's called Niemann-Pick disease. So, of course, many of your listeners most likely have never heard of this illness. It is a recessive gene, so each parent have a copy of the recessive gene, and that indicates that they don't have any complications from the illness, but they carry this silent recessive gene. Many of us, all of us, have many different varied recessive genes that we carry, but it only becomes a problem if the individual that we have a child with carries a matching recessive gene of that kind. And in this case, mom and dad each have a copy of the recessive gene. The baby receives one copy of the gene and then will develop Niemann-Pick disease. The disease that the foundation supports, there's two types. One is called Niemann-Pick disease type C, and the other is known as Niemann-Pick disease type A and B. They are two very different illnesses. It just so happened that the doctors who discovered them identified first Niemann-Pick A, then Niemann-Pick B, and then Niemann-Pick C. But our foundation supports both types.
So
what occurs with Niemann-Pick disease type C is that a protein does not fold properly within the cell, and that therefore does not allow cholesterol to pass through the cell appropriately. And it's the good cholesterol, the healthy cholesterol that our body makes that we need to function. So with the passing of time, the cholesterol builds up in the cell and then ultimately kills the cell. So most frequently, the disease conditions present themselves in children. It's, for the most part, about 65% of our patients will have no symptoms or any issues or concerns until they reach the age of perhaps 4 or 5 when they're entering school. They'll identify that there's perhaps some learning issues, some slow behaviors that will be raised to the parent or brought to the parent's attention by a school teacher. But what really is indicative of the disease is that the children then lose their skills, their cognitive skills. They start to regress. So they'll have memory issues, short-term memory issues, small motor skill issues like being able to hold a pencil or being able to draw and stay within the lines. I know that's always what most of us go back to when we first start school, is being able to color within the lines. They will have display some large or gross motor skills. For example, they may stumble a lot or trip. With the disease progression, they will begin to slur their words, have issues speaking, and again, the memory aspect that I discussed. This will often take a family to go to the doctor and to try and find out what could be the problem. Ultimately, although diagnosis does take quite a bit of time, they will be diagnosed with Niemann-Pick disease type C, which sadly, in the United States, there is no authorized FDA treatment for Niemann-Pick disease, and it is fatal in all cases with Niemann-Pick disease type C. So our foundation was started in 1992 with families who had children diagnosed with this disease, and they had been brought together at the National Institutes of Health for a clinical trial. And at that time, it was thought we knew cholesterol was the culprit, and it was thought that if we reduced the diet and took cholesterol out of the patient's diet and then worked with cholesterol-blocking medications, that the children would improve, that there would be a significant improvement. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the children all got worse. The cholesterol is a necessary aspect for our system's function, and by taking all the cholesterol out of the system, the body just said, oh gosh, I've got to work harder to increase my cholesterol production. And the children all got worse. The clinical trial was stopped. So we know that adjusting a patient's diet by reducing cholesterol in the diet is not a way in which to treat this therapeutically. We have a medication that is called Zavesca, or miglustat, which went through a clinical trial and was shown to slow the progression of the disease. And it has been approved in Canada, which is very, very fortunate for our Canadian patients, and in most of Europe. But the FDA in the United States did not approve that medication. So where our families in other countries outside of the U.S. have access to this drug to help slow the progression, it's not a cure, it's not a treatment, it is a therapy that helps slow the progression. It is a glimmer of hope for those patients because it does, as I said, slow the progression, and that gives us more time to look at other therapeutic options. So back to when the foundation began, these families that had come together at the NIH realized after the clinical trial had stopped what a resource it was to meet other families. If your listeners can think back to 1992, prior to the internet, when we still paid exorbitant prices to talk on the telephone, let alone to make calls internationally, it was very difficult for these seven families who had been brought together, two were from Europe, to communicate with one another, but they did so with letter writing, with the telephone as much as they could. They realized the contacts that they had made were so helpful in being able to manage their day-to-day challenges that they were facing with their child, that no doctors knew anything about this disease, no, their community didn't know, their family, the parents themselves didn't really know what were the next steps that they were going to be facing with the progression of the disease for their children. In fact, many of these patients or families, when their child was diagnosed, were all given the same paragraph of information from the medical literature, one paragraph describing the disease itself, and told to take their child home, to love them, and give them the best quality of life they could because there was nothing that they could do for their child. And that, in a way, really lit the burner under these parents and said, we are not going to take this. This is not what our child's life is going to be or have meaning. So those families founded the Niemann-Pick Disease Foundation. At the same time, the two European families as well began a group in Europe called the Niemann-Pick Disease Group, United Kingdom, and they worked hand-in-hand collaboratively, and we still do today, to build resources and raise awareness with regards to information, diagnosis within the medical community. Of course, when an individual or family is diagnosed, we're here to support them, to give them connections and networks to other families, perhaps to link to a doctor in their area or a neurologist who has already seen Niemann-Pick disease. And the most important aspect of the work that the foundation does now, 23 years later, is we work on funding research. So where we have gone over these 23 years, we had one clinical trial with the Prevesca, which failed. And there was a second clinical trial started last year. It actually started to see patients for a medication called cyclodextrin. That's happening at the National Institutes of Health. We had a second clinical trial kickoff for hemophilia type C adults, because we have, with the passing of time, learned that this disease is also has a mutation that doesn't show itself until late adolescence and into adulthood. So we have a clinical trial also taking place at the National Institutes of Health for adults with a medication called verinostat. And this next year, we hope to see a third clinical trial kick off with a medication that is being developed out of Sweden, a company called Orphazyme, that is developing a medicine with a drug chemical called a heat shock protein. So this is a new horizon for our families to tackle, really, how to move forward with regards to taking part in a clinical trial, which in essence is an experiment. They are drugs that have not been used in most cases in patients or humans before. So there's the worry of how this will interact when it's introduced to a patient versus the tests that have been done in mice and in cats and in dogs, in some cases in primates. But of course, the families are frantic for anything to save their child's life or to have any impact on the quality of life of their children. One additional aspect I think that your listeners will find quite interesting is that with the National Niemann-Pick Disease Foundation and the support that we gave, we also had lots of connection with our friends to the north in Canada, and made strong links with families in Canada who also had children diagnosed with Niemann-Pick Disease. And initially, we supported those families through the foundation here maintained in the United States. But it soon became apparent that those families, of course, had community networks, extended family, their coworkers, that also wanted to be supportive in a financial way and a volunteer way to those families and those children and loved ones diagnosed with Niemann-Pick Disease type C in Canada. So with the encouragement and support of the Niemann-Pick Disease Foundation in the United States, there was a family who was able to get charitable status for the Canadian chapter of the NNPDF. So that family lives just north of Toronto in Vaughan, Ontario, and they support families as well with both types of disease, Niemann-Pick Disease type C and Niemann-Pick Disease A and B. This family had two children with Niemann-Pick Disease type C, which tragically they have passed away. But this family stays very involved in the Canadian Foundation and works hand-in-hand with the U.S. Foundation to support families. One of the things that the Canadian group decided right from the get-go was that the U.S. had the family information, the family support services, the medical information for doctors and treating physicians was well-based, had a strong base, and was well-covered. So they didn't feel a need to have to reinvent those programs. So they actually work with our foundation here in the United States. In fact, we handle all their administrative support, so they don't have to hire another staff person or maintain an office. But we are able to offer the same services that any family in the U.S. would have with a diagnosis. We're also able to expand upon that and give those same services to our families in Canada. But, of course, we have identified who are the main researchers, where are the main clinics, and how best can a family in Canada who has a loved one with this disease be supported.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hiatus House is a social service agency offering confidential intervention for families experiencing domestic violence, including the Crisis Intervention Program, Residential Program, Transitional and Housing Support Program, Crossroads Program, Fresh Start Men's Program, Fresh Start Women's Program City, Fresh Start Women's Program Country, and the Hiatus House School-Based Program. If you are interested or for more information, please contact us. Call us at 519-252-7781 or visit our website at www.hiatushouse.com or come to our location at 250 Lewis Avenue, Windsor. Contact Hiatus House. Get safe, get help.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Nadine Hill, director of the National Niemann Pick Disease Foundation. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from the director of CanChild. Some of the views expressed in the following interview are solely those of the individual and don't necessarily reflect those of anyone at CJAM 99.1 FM. So tell me a little bit about CanChild.
So CanChild is a Center for Childhood Disability Research at McMaster University. We just have celebrated our 25th anniversary, and we are doing research in the field of childhood disability research, recognizing that children with disabilities and their families are faced with many issues that require our attention, and through research we want to help these children and families.
So, what types of disabilities are most common that you find?
At CanChild, we take what we call a non-categorical approach. We really like to look across conditions, as there is so much in common across disabilities. But typically, we look at, you can think of disabilities like cerebral palsy, spina bifida, brain injuries, difficulties with motor coordination, autism, and speech and language disabilities. So quite a range of disabilities. So CanChild is a center for childhood disability research, and we don't provide services ourselves, but we have a strong interest and have a good relationship with service providers. Our work has always been informed by therapists, physicians, social workers, working with the families. And if you go back, that's actually how CanChild started. There was a need to look at, for example, how children with cerebral palsy develop in terms of their walking abilities. So that was a question that we worked with with therapists, and has through research we have learned how children with cerebral palsy develop. We also look at how can we best provide treatment and services to the children and families, and wanted to know what families think of it in terms of what is good service. And so we have developed a measure, it's called the Measure of Processes of Care, that helps us to understand what the experiences are with the services.
So, in terms of research, who's the target audience?
Well, it depends, I would say. For sure, we have always the children and the families in mind, and they are at the center of everything we do. I think a lot of our research work has informed the field. So basically the therapists and the service providers working directly with the families and the children. But also we have worked with policymakers and trying to understand how best health services can be provided and how they can be evaluated to ensure that the best treatment is given to the right patient at the right time.
So, are there any projects in the works for CanChild?
Yes, we are particularly now interested in what happens when the children with disabilities grow up and become teenagers and become adults. Typically, children are seen by children's treatment centers and children's hospitals. But when they grow up, there is a different world out there. We call it transition into adulthood. So at around age 18 or 21, they leave the children's hospital, they leave high school, and they basically on their own. They have to find a job or an situation where they can live and work or have a meaningful life, potentially have a relationship, and so forth. And that's what we now want to study through our research, so we can learn from adults with child onset disabilities and can then feed that back to the therapists that are now treating younger children.
So, are there any challenges in the research itself?
Well, I think part of the challenge is the complexity. If you think of the lives of children with disabilities and their families, there are so many aspects that are influenced by the disability, not only because of the disability, but also because of what we call the environment. So think of what happens at school if a child with a disability is being bullied. That has an impact on his well-being and also impact on later functioning, how you function as an adult. So that's something we have to think beyond the person with the disability. We have to look at the child within the family and within the community. And that is part of our challenge.
So, on the converse side, in your time doing this research, has there been any success that stood out for you?
For sure. I think one thing we have learned over the 25 years of research at CanChild is that we may not put all our eggs in the basket to what we call to fix the child. So a disability may come with, or the condition may come with some limitations, but that doesn't mean that someone can function well in daily life and have a meaningful life. So in the past, we were very much focused on trying to fix the impairment in the hope that a child would have better outcomes in daily life. Through our research, we have learned that we may want to focus on other aspects, such as the family, the daily activities, we call them function, physical activity and fitness, their friends, and also looking at what is going to happen in the future. And all these words start with an F, and we call them the F words in childhood disability. We recently wrote a research paper on that.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Something really spoke to me today, folks, during the interviews, when it was said, take these kids home, give them a good quality of life, there's nothing that can be done. No parent worth their salt would accept that, or should. They should search and ask questions, try to find alternatives, try to find a way. That's what it's all about in disability life, seeking an alternative. One method of doing something doesn't necessarily fit one's abilities, look for another way. 9 times out of 10, there is a way to get things done. It's just a matter of taking the time, taking the effort, asking questions. But being assertive is one of the key factors in this, folks. It's a matter of knowing that you do have the right to ask questions. If something feels out of place, you have a right to know why things are the way they are. The truth is, if by asking a question today, you can improve the quality of life, these children, these people with disabilities, in the long term, it's absolutely worth it. For a parent facing a child's illness for the first time, it can be a frightening thing. It can be overwhelming. It can be daunting, even. But the truth is, it's something that has to be done. On behalf of these young people who do have a right to life and consideration, it's up to us in society to take all the steps we can to be there, to support them, to help them reach their best. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink for HandyLink, the numeral 4, at gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. As new information, new developments come out related to disabilities research, society is finding more and more that there are answers. It's just a matter of taking the time and the care to look for them. Back before the internet, back before the information age, it would have been a lot more difficult to find substantial information, research being done. But I maintain those parents were truly devoted to the work, the cause, finding out all they can, who've made these long-lasting support groups, are the ones that really had the heart for this work. And the impact of changing these lives cannot be underestimated. Granted, these children were very young when some of these support groups began, but over the years, they've grown into the leaders of tomorrow. They have come lead richer, fuller lives because these parents and these researchers both took it upon themselves to say, I'm not giving up. I know there is an answer. Might not be in plain sight, but I'm going to look and I'm going to find it. And I think these young ones with disabilities do tend to notice the love and the devotion that is being undertaken on their behalf. What greater gift can we give to succeeding generations than that of hope, than that of saying, we don't have a definite cure today, but we're taking the steps so that someday we will get there. And that day could happen any time. If you live in hope, saying to yourself, today could be the day that my life changes for the better. One of those days, you will be right. Truth is, it's easy to say, there's no hope, there's no cure, we don't have answers, we don't have resources. But what it really comes down to is life itself, potential. There's no way to know what a person with a disability might accomplish if given the right tools and given something that will help them live a longer, more enriched life. There's no telling what they might accomplish. That potential is the same in everyone, whether they have a disability or not. The potential to create, to live, to learn, to grow, it's all the same. Simply a matter of finding the right outlet by which to reach them. And that may take time, effort, research, but I guarantee you it is entirely worth it. Nothing in this world can touch a heart quite like seeing a person with a disability realizing that there is hope, seeing the smile that comes out of them. It's a gift I think more members of society should get to experience. Just recognizing that disability life is simply that, life. The potential to create, potential to make the world a better place. Whether a person has a disability or not, we all hope that in our time we can just make the world a little better than when we found it. And those who stand by individuals with disabilities are doing exactly that. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.